A significant moment in the Catholic clergy abuse crisis in the US overnight, the Diocese of Providence, Rhode Island, has published a list of 48 priests and deacons described by the church as credibly accused of sexually abusing minors. It's the first time since the sexual abuse scandal broke not far north of Providence in Boston almost two decades ago that this has happened. Seeing names of their abusers has already been cathartic for some victims. But lawyer Timothy Conlon, who works with abuse victims in the Providence area, says it's far from a full accounting by a still secretive church. We spoke earlier.
They've been asked for a number of years to release information about what they know in connection with abuse allegations, and they've given various figures in various court filings. This is the first time that they've publicly released names, however. So it's the first opportunity that the public has to literally go and look up, if you will, someone who the church itself admits they had credible allegations regarding.
And how was the list determined? And importantly, are there still potential abusers who are not on this list?
Well, there certainly are people who we are aware of that, frankly, we consider to be, quote, credibly accused of abuse that are not on that list. So there's quite a bit of controversy with regards to what the church deemed credible as opposed to what somebody else deems credible.
And I've read that this is a list of 48 priests and deacons, but I've read that up to 300 names have been spoken of. Is that right?
I wouldn't rule 300 out. I was looking at a court document in which they cited 85 as recently as, I'm going to say, 2007, which again, I think is low as well. I'm really not certain what it is that the church is using by way of its barometer, if you will. There have been times that they've complained that they would have to produce reams and reams of records were they having to respond to our requests for this kind of information, basically suggesting that it would be an onerous burden. So I've seen, because they were forced to expose, you know, to viewing cases and cases of documents that they've stockpiled with regards to these allegations. So it's not as if we were standing there counting priests, you know, on our hands as we were doing it. And I haven't gone back through the records that I've seen to do a head count and a cross check. That's the process that we're involved in as we speak.
With the publication of this list, the bishop, Thomas Tobin, described it as an expression of transparency and accountability, I've read, by the church. Do you think that's a fair summation?
Honestly, no. I think that they're releasing the list is positive, and I don't wish to mince words about commending them, because I do think that it is better that they do this than they not do it, in the sense that, I mean, they've been asked to do it for probably a decade. So it's certainly good that they did something. But to suggest that this gives them transparency and openness, I think is just absurd. The way the list is compiled is as puzzling as anything else. I can tell you, because I reviewed it carefully within moments of it coming out, there are priests, for instance, that they list as credibly having been accused of abuse and removed from the ministry at a point in time that frankly, well afterwards, they were busy publicly denying were abusers. So it's as if they're talking out of both sides of their mouth in connection with this. And then the flipping it around, there are names that are not on the list where people have, I wasn't physically present when these allegations were lodged, but I've interviewed people who know the names of the investigators who they've met with from the diocese. And, you know, I certainly can corroborate that those people are, in fact, employed by the diocese. And the pattern of of questioning and such is very consistent with typical diocesan questioning. So when someone says he met with so-and-so and this is what they were asked, it sounds very familiar to what I've heard from a number of other victims. They then say that the diocesan representative told them they were not the only person lodging a complaint against such and such a priest, but that priest is not on that list. So as to the victims who see their perpetrator's name, I think it's very powerful and potentially helpful and healing. And for that, I appreciate that they were at least as candid as they were in admitting that these people were credibly accused. It's a positive step. It'd be like saying, and this may seem like an absurd metaphor, but I mean, if someone copped to their wife to cheating and admitted that they had, you know, occasionally done something they shouldn't have done, that is accurate and I guess better than lying about it entirely. However, if they've had, say, 45 girlfriends and been out, you know, 72 times, then saying it was a couple of times with so-and-so is actually not transparent or open. So I don't know if that makes any sense,
yeah.
But I mean, the bottom line is it's telling a half truth, if you will, to suggest that this is a credible list. You know, it's a list of the people that they choose to acknowledge as that were credibly accused by their own standard. And there's no explanation of that standard. It's a list of people they claim to have removed from ministry in an instance where I can tell you that their lawyers, well after the date that they say they removed them, were denying that these people were perpetrators. So there's a bunch of doublespeak going on buried in that list. And what's not on the list is at least as interesting as what's on it.
With the publication of the list, survivors presumably will see names that have not been made public before. Presumably also they'll identify that they're not the only victims of particular abuses. I mean, is this going to have a multiplier effect?
I had one of those conversations with a woman today.
Right. What did she say?
She said that she realized she was not the only one. That this sick, I was going to use a word that I know you can't use on the radio, but this very sick puppy had a girl who he beguiled in the second grade, believing that he was in love with her. So she carried on and was his special chosen, how do we say, pet, friend, girlfriend, whatever, from the second grade through the eighth grade, with her believing that this was love. And she genuinely did not understand that she was but one of many young girls that was preyed upon.
How old is she now?
I can't say that I recall. I'm going to say she's in her 40s, but I really can't swear to it.
But decades, is decades later, she realizes.
Right. I mean, I spoke with three victims today, each of whom, for an hour each at least, okay, each of whom had some relatively profound, one instance, I mean, extremely profound reaction to seeing this. And I mean, to be honest, I was like walking slowly away from my desk looking for water after spending an hour plus on the phone with a woman who, during that conversation, was literally coming to grips with the fact that she was a sexual abuse victim. She knew what had happened, but she had been beguiled. I mean, the thing that you have to understand that's so difficult to understand if you haven't spent a lot of time speaking to these people is that the way that the person accomplishes what he does is that they normalize the behavior. So they get the kid to believe that this is okay, that this is, if it's a little bit edgy, it's still their secret, that this is a special relationship that the two of them have. And this person loves them and cares about them. And so this child in second grade or third grade is co-opted into a relationship that's perverse. But once it's off and running, they're not equipped, you know, in the third, fourth, and fifth grade to blow the whistle on it. It's just a part of their life at that point. She thought of this guy as a father figure and as a boyfriend, which makes no sense. But, you know, if you're in the second grade, how hard can it be to co-opt the mind of a second grader?
The other thing that's happened is the governor, Gina Raimondo, has signed an extension of the statute of limitations in quite a dramatic way. Can you describe what is actually happening with that and what it will mean for survivors?
Well, what it will mean is ultimately something that is going to play itself out in the courts over the course of the next 3 or 4 years, perhaps even more. What it clearly means in the most global sense is that over time, the level of accountability for institutions and for predators has been notched up significantly. In terms of people today who were offended against many years ago, there's almost certainly going to be litigation about how the statute is going to be construed and applied on a case-by-case basis. But it certainly radically broadens the remedies that are available, particularly going forward.
So do you expect a flood of new suits against the diocese as a result of this set of actions?
I wouldn't use the word flood. I really wouldn't. I do expect that there will be litigation filed. I do think that certainly more than a handful of cases. But it's inevitable that the process that started back in Boston in 2002, really, is not finished. The system has not flushed itself out of this, you know, vile chapter. Realistically, I mean, I could go on, and I don't want to bore you, but I mean, in terms of the records that we went through, these practices and these problems have plagued the church for centuries, literally centuries. And it's only within the last, you know, 30 years that it's become the subject matter of litigation. And then it's only since 2002 that the public has caught on to the fact that this is actually a systemic problem in the church. The church didn't meaningfully confront addressing this problem. They were in damage control mode until 2002. They're still in damage control mode to a certain extent, but I think they genuinely understand that there is a problem. In 2001, it was all about making the problem go away. Now, that's still at least in part their motivation, at least as I can see it. But there is some genuine effort to try to fix the situation, and the public awareness is hyped up to the point where they can't get away with the stuff that they used to get away with in terms of waltzing priests out of police stations and telling kids or telling mothers that it was okay to let their kids sleep over at a rectory. So, I mean, those kinds of behaviors, which were part and parcel of the norm for these pedophiles back in the 60s and 70s, those behaviors are gone. I don't think anybody would let their kids sleep over at a rectory now.
Yes, a long and painful process. Timothy Conlon, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Sure. You're quite welcome.
US lawyer Timothy Conlon. A lot more on the details of that situation in the full interview on the PM website.